Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
By the way, we're in the midst of our member drive. If you're interested in donating, we would really appreciate it. Go to nprnews.org/donate. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the quest for Pluto and beyond. For all of the sophisticated technology and intellectual horsepower it took to send a spacecraft to Pluto, it was a 17-year-old kid's determination and an old-fashioned letter-writing campaign that resurrected the project from near death. Indeed, the path to a Pluto flyby was anything but smooth. As Alan Stern, the project manager, writes in the preface to the new book he co-authored, "Nothing quite like New Horizons has occurred in a generation, the raw exploration of new worlds, and nothing quite like it is currently planned to happen ever again." Alan Stern is a planetary scientist, project manager of the New Horizons expedition, and co-author, along with David Grinspoon, of Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. And he joins us today from San Francisco. Alan, it's an honor to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I was wondering if the commitment that you had to bring to saving the Pluto mission a number of times really required you to articulate a number of times just how bold this mission was. I mean, you really had to show and tell, right, what was meaningful about taking this craft to Pluto.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we did have to articulate that many, many times to navigate the Washington, D.C. maze that ultimately resulted in our getting funded. And we had to win a very steep proposal competition against the Goliaths of this industry, our kind of underdog, kind of David versus Goliath team, managed to win that competition and get the keys to be the team that built a spacecraft and flew it across the solar system for NASA to explore the farthest worlds in the history of exploration.
I mean, maybe that process, right, as long as it was and how difficult it was at times, really forced you to think through what it meant to do this. I don't know, in a way that maybe other space expeditions, you know, don't require. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm sure that we did. We had an exceptionally difficult birth. It took 14 years from the time that we first walked in the door to talk to NASA about building a spacecraft and flying it to Pluto until we were out of the woods in terms of getting it started and getting it funded. And obviously, our thinking had to sharpen up over that period of time. But there were a number of times when we thought we almost had it within our grasp, and we were knocked down, and had to find a new way to do it, and you know, kind of get up and dust ourselves off. And I think that's part of what makes Chasing New Horizons a very different book. Not so much a book for people who are interested in space exploration, but a book for people who are interested in humans with ambition and drive and who won't take no for an answer and overcoming very steep odds. It's a human story, and it's kind of a thriller.
You know, I appreciate that you said that because, yes, while there's a lot of gee whiz science and technology in this, I agree. It's really, in the best sense of the word, it is about resilience, and it's about the core, what it means to truly believe and to commit, right, in the face of a lot of skepticism, you know, to almost fail, right, and to not let that almost, why don't they see the excitement in this, deter you.
Absolutely right. And I was fortunate to have an amazing team of people who were very determined and very ingenious and just unwilling to let go because they knew that what they were driving for was important. And I think that story translates to almost any walk of life. I think that the most important bit, really, and we say this at the end of Chasing New Horizons, is the way that in the end, when we succeeded at this, it touched so many people way beyond the science, just in terms of the achievement, how many children and how many parents and how many people around the world and in this country were inspired by the determination and drive and the success of it. I can't tell you how many people have said to us since we accomplished it, thank you. And there's never been anything like this in my lifetime.
So I mentioned that 17-year-old boy who, on one of the near-death experiences of the Pluto Project, gets this letter-writing campaign going. And I think at one point you call him a brilliant tactician because he understands at a visceral level how to capture the imagination of the American people, and he inspires a big letter-writing campaign. How did that play out?
Well, it was interesting, you know, and we're talking about a scene that's taking place in the year 2000, so a long time ago, and different personalities who are now at NASA. But this kid at the time, a high schooler living in Hershey, Pennsylvania, actually got in a car and drove himself downtown to Washington, D.C. and went to NASA headquarters and beseeched the powers that be, if you will, about how important it was to him and he thought to his generation that something like this happened in their time. And the bureaucrats of the day said, well, who put you up to this? Who's paying for your trip? You know, there must be something nefarious going on. Is there some big corporation or university, or did Stern and his gang of scientists, put you up to this trip? Or did they pay for your gas? And he said, it's just me. And this is really important.
What do you think he understood about what this would mean to Americans that maybe those bureaucrats that you were talking about didn't understand in the moment? What did this 17-year-old kid get about it?
He saw the romance in it, beyond the technology, beyond the science that was promised. He saw this as something inspirational, as a kind of climbing of Mount Everest, Pluto being the farthest planet and the most difficult to achieve of all the original planets known at the birth of the space age. He saw unfinished business in that we had explored the planets out to Neptune, but not Pluto. And he just got it that it was inspirational and it was very important to him.
One of the other setbacks on the climb, the Everest climb, is this moment, and it's late in the process, when you and some of your other scientists start to ask the question as to whether the craft and the atmosphere that you're sending the craft into, it's really a black widow, right? That you're going to get all that way, and then the craft is going to deconstruct. Do I understand the questions that you were asking about this?
You sure do. This is to orient folks. This is now long after we launched, as we were approaching Pluto at this crazy speed of 32,000 miles an hour, so fast that had the spacecraft been hit by even something smaller than a rice pellet, it would have destroyed the spacecraft. And we started to discover that Pluto had not one, but three, and then four, and then five moons. We were discovering these with Hubble, and they kept popping up. And we thought to ourselves as scientists, you know, how many are undiscovered? And might some of these have rings that are associated with them? And the rings are full of gravel and particulates and so forth. And if we fly through this, this spacecraft is going to be shredded. So as you alluded to, and as we say in Chasing New Horizons, we were a little bit worried that the subject of our affection, that is Pluto, could in fact be a black widow and could sting us. So we had to make very detailed plans to search for hazards and to make sure that we were prepared to avoid them in case that anything came up.
I think we also have to mention that in the course of this whole project, Pluto ends up getting demoted from planet status. And I know how you feel about this. I want to talk about that in a minute. But when you got, were you aware that this debate was going on within the scientific community. And were you aware that they were taking this question as seriously as they were taking it, that some decision like the one that came out was going to happen?
Well, I was aware that there were people in another field, not in planetary science, not experts in the study of our solar system and what planets are about, but the astronomers, people who study stars and galaxies far away, were wringing their hands about all of the discoveries being made in our outer solar system of new planets, Pluto's cohort, if you will, small planets like Pluto with names like Sedna and Eris and Makemake and Ixion and so forth. And they were kind of thinking through the problem wrong. They were worried that school children would freak out about having to name too many planets in a classroom exercise instead of accepting the fact this is science, we're discovering new data, let's adjust to it. You know, if you grew up on a desert island and there were only 8 or 9 palm trees, you might give them names and think, well, those are very special. They're the only things like this in the world, until you develop the technology to travel around the world and see that there were an uncountable number of palm trees, and you were just wrong about it. I call what the astronomers did BS. That stands for bad science. They weren't thinking about adapting to new data. They were actually instead trying to decree that there will be no more planets.
You had some other strong words for this. So this happened in 2006. And on the day that Pluto was removed from status as a planet, you said, "I'm embarrassed for astronomy. It won't stand. It's a farce." It has stood so far, hasn't it?
Well, not really. And I think that that's in part, forgive me, but I think it's in part due to the uncritical nature of the press with this.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's take a different profession. Let's take medicine as an example. There are many specialties. And if a convention of podiatrists, foot doctors, made some pronouncements about recommended good practices for neurology, you wouldn't take them very seriously because they're not neurologists, right?
Uh-huh.
So the astronomers made a proclamation about something that's out of their league in planetary science. It would be as bad as if planetary scientists started categorizing black holes, which we know very little about. It's a different specialty. And the press simply accepted that as a fait accompli. In fact, in planetary science, which is a field with thousands of practitioners around the world, Pluto and the other small planets are routinely considered planets, and the field kind of laughs off what the astronomers did. But the press has unfortunately continued to promulgate this as if it were some sort of canon from on a high, handed down from from heaven.
Okay, so this is really valuable for me to know. You're saying that this pronouncement that Pluto is no longer a planet is not accepted by the people that do the kind of work you do. It's not accepted by NASA. It's just accepted in this small circle of astronomists who feel like they, you know, looked at the science and made well-informed determinations. Is that what you're saying?
Well, very much so. I won't speak for NASA. They're a government agency, and they'll do what they want. And I don't think NASA gets involved in decisions like this. It's really about how science is done. And if you were to go quietly, let's say, to any professional planetary science meeting where new research results are being reported, and you sat in the room, let's say, for the session about new results with Pluto, I would predict that you would hear virtually every speaker get up and refer to this place as a planet. So just be a fly on the wall and go do the experiment, and you will find that what the astronomers did is largely ignored.
Hmm. So one more question about this. So is it the science informing this determination that you have to maintain Pluto as a planet? I mean, is it all based on science, or is it this? I mean, is there some emotion attached to this? Some kind of romance? You used that word a couple minutes ago. Attached to the idea that we can't remove Pluto's planetary status.
Well, I think Pluto's incidental to this in our field, in planetary science. Up until the 1990s, when we looked out across the sky, we could count 9 planets, from Mercury to Pluto. But beginning in the 1990s, and that's now a quarter century ago, we started to discover more and more small planets. In fact, so many of them that they outnumber the larger planets. This upended our idea of, you know, how the solar system formed. The solar system made many more small planets than large planets. And just as, you know, we as humans are not offended by the fact that most organisms on Earth are insects, not mammals, we got a little dose of reality from the data when we discovered that planets like the Earth and Mars and Jupiter and Saturn are the oddballs, and it's the small planets that are actually the norm. Pluto was the first discovered of these, and it's in the mix, and it's the one that it's easy for, I think, people in the press to talk about. But this is not an argument about Pluto. It's an argument about understanding the central objects in our field called planetary science. We want to understand what objects fit in the category of planets and which do not.
This is really valuable. I'm glad you've clarified that with us.
By the way,
go ahead.
If I might recount very briefly a debate that I had on Ira Flatow's Science Friday on National Public Radio now a dozen years ago with one of the primary astronomer proponents that we should limit the number of planets to a small number on behalf of school children. I remember that this individual, a Caltech professor named Mike Brown, said to Ira and myself, you know, we just can't have 50 planets. Kids will never remember their names. And Ira handed it to me and he said, Alan, that sounds pretty good. What do you think? And I said, Ira, if we're going to go to 8 planets, I guess we're going to have to go from 50 down to 8 states, aren't we?
Alan Stern is with us this morning. He is a planetary scientist, the project manager of the New Horizons expedition, and co-author, along with David Grinspoon, of Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. I want to come back to what you said about the moons around Pluto and some of the other characteristics of the planet. I thought this was an interesting part of the book, that astronomer Mark Showalter used the Hubble telescope to identify these new moons around the planet. What did you not understand about the atmosphere in which Pluto existed and these moons around Pluto that ended up being pretty important to the mission?
Well, what we didn't understand originally was that Pluto has a collection of small moons and that those could potentially present a hazard to flight to our spacecraft because it's traveling so fast. Even though the spacecraft is jacketed in a Kevlar bulletproof shield, if it's hit by things that are sufficiently large, they'll get through the Kevlar shield and destroy electronics or a fuel tank or what have you. After coming all this way, 14 years to get the funding, 4 years to get it built, and 9 years to cross the solar system, it would have been tragic had we, on Pluto's doorstep, had our spacecraft lost to an impact and nothing would have come of it from the standpoint of scientific results or exploration achievement.
How unusual are the numbers of moons that Pluto has and the characteristics of those moons? I mean, will you find other planets in the region that are similar to this, or is there something pretty unusual about the way Pluto exists there?
That's a great question. Let me do a little 101. You know, among the four small planets in the inner solar system, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, there's only one large moon. It's our moon, orbits the Earth. Mars has two little rocks that orbit it called Phobos and Deimos. By rocks, I mean things a few tens of miles across. Venus and Mercury have no moons. Now, if you move further outward to the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they each have dozens and dozens of moons, some large enough that they would be called planets if they orbited the sun, and others are just rocks again. Now, let's go to the third zone of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt, where Pluto and these other small planets orbit. Pluto was discovered in 1930. In 1978, it was discovered to have a large moon, half its own size, and that was a headline then. Then in the 1990s, as we started to discover lots more small planets, that was a headline. And then in the early 2000s, some of those worlds, those small planets in the Kuiper Belt, were discovered to have moons of their own. We went looking for more moons of Pluto using the Hubble because if they were there, we wanted to know to point our cameras and spectrometers at them on this one and only mission to Pluto, the one chance to take data and learn about this whole system. And in less than 2 hours, a fraction of an afternoon, Hubble discovered two new satellites of Pluto. So the count went from one to three. And then a few years later, a fourth one was discovered, and then a fifth one. And that is a something more like a giant planet system than anything down here in the inner solar system. Mm-hmm. Since then, other planets in the Kuiper Belt have been discovered to have multiple moons, but none as many as Pluto yet. That's probably because Pluto is just better studied than all of them. And I think over time we'll see still more moons discovered around small planets. But it turns out that many have satellites, and many even have multiple satellites. So Pluto's kind of typical. It's a record holder, but not exceptionally so in the deep outer solar system.
Is it exceptional in that it takes Pluto, I think you tell us in the book, 6.4 days, Earth days, to rotate on its axis. Is that right?
Right. Pluto's what we call a slow rotator. Most worlds in the solar system turn on their axis in a period ranging from about 10 hours to about the period of the Earth's 24 hours. Mars is very much like the Earth. The giant planets are typically rotate quicker. Then there are exceptions like Venus that takes almost 250 days to turn on its axis. But Pluto would be an outlier at 6.4 days. And that's largely due to its big satellite called Charon, which actually slowed the planet's rotation over time down to this almost week-long period.
So what does it mean for the characteristics of the atmosphere and the surface of Pluto, if anything, that it rotates that slowly? I mean, does that change anything about the way Pluto is?
It does. It has some effects, for example, on the dynamics of the atmosphere. There's a term in the dynamics, and when you write down the equations, called a Coriolis force, and that's proportional to the length of the day. And because the length of the day is longer, the Coriolis force is smaller. That would be one example. But I think really, and more importantly, the fact that it rotated slowly had a large impact on the flyby that we plan, because we're coming screaming up at almost 1 million miles per day, and we're going to swoop down and study in great detail the planet. But because it's rotating slowly, that meant that we would only get to see one side of it in great detail. The other side would be largely unknown, because you would see it half a rotation out 3 days before and from almost 3 million miles away. So when we first thought this mission out and were proposing it and hoping to win it in the competition, we included a big telescope on board the spacecraft. It was named LORI, for the Long Range Reconnaissance Imager, that could be our long eyes, if you will, that could look even from millions of miles away and help us explore the far side of Pluto to overcome the quandary that the slow rotation imposed on a single spacecraft mission.
I thought your description of the necessity and the details about how to create a spacecraft that hibernates was really interesting. As the scientists came to this problem to solve, give me a sense of why they knew they were going to have to put the craft into hibernation and what a challenge it is to design. I guess it's designing software, right, that can allow the craft to do it.
Right, right. And we were the first mission to use operational hibernation on an extensive basis. It had been tested a little bit, but one of the greatest challenges for New Horizons when we were selected by NASA was that the budget that was allocated was very small compared to previous really deep space missions like this. The Voyagers, for example, that had explored the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in turn, had a budget that was five times what we were allocated. So really, we were faced with having to make a price point breakthrough, if you will. And it wasn't just the scientists. It was really the engineering team working with the scientists who scratched our head and, you know, found a number of what I call intelligent compromises for the way that we could innovate to save cost. And one of them was hibernation. And, you know, when Voyager flew across the solar system, it took a staff of 450 people to take care of those spacecraft, plan their flybys, analyze the scientific data, all of that. We only had 50 belly buttons, 50 individuals to do the same job. And so we had to figure out how on that staff we could do essentially the same thing. Hibernation was a breakthrough that allowed us to do that, because by putting the spacecraft to sleep most of each year, we could turn away from constantly monitoring it 24/7 with a mission control that's staffed around the clock, people who are sending commands and analyzing the data that's coming back, and let the spacecraft, through more modern software techniques, take care of itself. And remember, it's very far from Earth. At Pluto, for example, sending a signal back to the Earth at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, takes 4.5 hours one way. So when something goes wrong, that's a 9-hour round-trip time for somebody on Earth to flip a switch, take an action, and do something about it. By then, the problem could be over. If it's a fuel leak, all the fuel could have leaked out. If it's a computer reset, things could get pretty bad in 9 hours and so forth. So we built software that resided on the spacecraft that could detect faults as if there was an astronaut aboard, and then take action to mitigate against those faults, like close a valve if the fuel is leaking, to shut off the supply of fuel, or if there's a computer reboot, go to the backup computer. It was more sophisticated than that, but that's the general idea, and that helped us save money, and it also helped us make for a more reliable space flight to Pluto.
But just so I understand this, I mean, there is risk in putting the craft into hibernation mode, too, even with all the kind of fail safes that you build in. The craft goes to sleep and maybe you can't wake it up, just to be really simplistic about it.
Yeah, well, let's not be too simplistic. The spacecraft is not turned off. We turn off as many systems as we can, but the main computer is still operating.
Okay.
The power generator is still operating. The receivers are still on, so we can always talk to it from the Earth. And the software on board has some what we call watchdogs. If a spacecraft hasn't heard from Earth after a predetermined period, then it wakes itself up. If it comes time to wake up according to the flight plan, it wakes itself up. And we never had a problem with that in flight. The entire hibernation system worked very, very well. We had some other problems along the way, mostly minor, but the hibernation system was actually very well thought out and very reliable.
It also turned out, though, it sounds like when you were thinking about the observation instruments that were going to be on the craft, you had to build in the possibility that the craft wouldn't be positioned exactly as it should be, so that the instruments might not be pointing directly where they should. Am I understanding the challenge of that?
Yeah, there was a very, very steep navigational challenge that, in order to meet the scientific objectives that NASA laid out in great detail, that the spacecraft had to arrive at Pluto at just the right time and at just the right place. Regarding its position, we had to fly through a 40 by 60 mile rectangular window in space for everything to line up. That sounds like a pretty big barn door.
No, it doesn't.
But if you're aiming from 3 billion miles away, it's a steep challenge. Someone calculated for me that that's the equivalent of hitting a golf shot from L.A. to New York City and landing a hole in one, literally in the cup.
Wow!
And then we had to also arrive with a stringent timing requirement. After 9.5 years, we actually had to arrive within 450 seconds of the predetermined time.
Man.
In order for all of the moons and Pluto to be in the right place for the spacecraft to take the images and spectra and so forth. And that's a steep challenge, but our navigation team more than checked the box. After all that time and flying from 2006 to 2015, 9.5 years, they arrived only 86 seconds off target.
That's incredible.
And we were early, so there.
You know, I just had a conversation with Simon Winchester about his book on precision engineering. You probably haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's just come out. But we talked about how necessary the pursuit of precision is, what it means to the imagination of the people pursuing it, but also how accustomed we, the non-scientists in the world who use the devices that operate on this extraordinary precision engineering, how unaware we are of it, how it's just become expected. And then I hear the calculations that you did, and I think that is the most precise of the most precise of the kind of precise engineering. I want to make sure we understand how extraordinary this is.
Well, let me put this in a different perspective.
Okay.
Realize that we had one spacecraft flying to Pluto to make a one-shot flyby with no redo, no repeat, no second chance. And I think had we thought any part of the analysis out incorrectly, not just the navigational challenges that we just talked about, but all the other software challenges to get the flyby right and to run this very complex piece of machinery called New Horizons, it could have very easily gone bad because there are thousands of ways to fail, literally, and there's only one way to succeed when everything works.
Talk to me just a bit about how you you account for that possibility of failure. I'm interested in how the team thinks about that. Yes, I know it's making sure you get the right calculations into the computer, but I'm really more interested in the emotional spirit of how the team approaches the idea of failure.
Well, we take it as a challenge. And it's all about thinking through the problem in great detail and from every possible angle and hoping that you have left no stone unturned. And so we routinely peer review the work. We bring in outside experts, people who have not been part of the decision-making and the solution process to critique it. And we accept that critique as something that makes us stronger and helps us weed out problems, because when we actually do the flyby, there'll be no redo, as I said before. And then we do a lot of testing. We tested that flyby dozens of times on the spacecraft simulator located at our mission control in Maryland. We had computer programs that analyzed all of the different functions that were going on to model how well they would work and even work in the face of various adversities or miscalculations. And all of that ultimately produced a successful, really textbook flyby. But it only came through the very hard work and diligence of this this team. And I like to say, you know, spaceflight is a team sport. No spaceflight's ever been done by a single individual. And it was really the New Horizons team that made that successful.
You know, but I think you said something important there, which is the when there were critiques, you couldn't on this team afford to be so attached to an idea of like, this is how it has to go. And we designed this and it's been years and we're invested. You know, you had to let go of some of that. You took the critique really seriously, which I imagine
wasn't always
easy to do.
You're absolutely right. And I can tell you that I often said on the project, you know, we have to let go of what's been invented here. You know, we have to accept whatever's best. And if the idea comes from the outside and somebody has a better idea than we had and it makes it more reliable or more efficient, we need to embrace that. And the other thing, which is a little counterintuitive, but I said it a lot, is please bring me problems. Please bring me problems as soon as you can and in as large a number as you can, because the earlier you can start to tackle a problem before it grows and becomes intractable, the more likely that you can actually check the box and mitigate it. And so we like lots of little problems instead of letting things fester and ending up with a few big and very difficult to solve problems.
Alan Stern is with us. If you've just tuned into the show, we're talking about the new book that he's co-authored along with David Grinspoon called Chasing New Horizons: Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. And in the course of our conversation, we've worked our way up to the moment when the team realizes that the spacecraft is working as it should, and we're in mission control. So, Alan, put us in mission control on that day, in that moment. What was it like?
So I think you're referring to just after the Pluto flyby, about 12 hours later, after closest approach. The spacecraft had been very busy because while it's at close to Pluto, we don't want to take time out to point away from Pluto and talk to the Earth. We accepted that delayed gratification that it should be collecting data all the time, but about 12 hours. We took a short break. Spacecraft turned using its thrusters, pointed the dish antenna back to the Earth, and sent an engineering report for how the flyby had gone. Now, that signal takes 4.5 hours at the speed of light to cross the solar system back to Earth, where NASA's football field-sized antennas, the Deep Space Network, received that signal, transmitted it to our mission control in Maryland. Our engineers were looking at the telemetry reports from the different spacecraft systems, propulsion, guidance, command and data handling, etc., and they all looked good. And our mission operations manager, the boss of our mission control, Alice Bowman, having gotten good reports from each of her engineers, each of those men and women, reported on the public address system. She called my name. She said, "Mission Principal Investigator, the spacecraft has had a successful flyby of the Pluto system and is now outbound with data." And it was just pandemonium. It was like one of those scenes in the movie Apollo 13 where people were, you know, fist bumping and hugging and jumping up and down and slapping each other on the back and knowing that everything we worked so hard to achieve had turned out well.
In your life, over the arc of your life, where do you put that moment?
I wouldn't say it topped some of the events with the birth and some of the achievements our children have had. But in terms of my career, I would say that was as good as it gets. I worked 26 years from the day that we decided to go ask NASA to study a mission to Pluto until that sentence was uttered that it had been successful. And 2,500 men and women, 2,500 Americans worked on this project in one way or another over time. Designing and building the spacecraft, designing and building the launch vehicle, designing and building the nuclear power supply for it, and then flying it across the solar system. And for that big team, this was success for people who had worked, in most cases, 15 or more years on the project to see it work. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that. This was the Super Bowl for us.
How many of those 2,500 people that worked on the project know what the Pluto salute is? Does everybody?
I think most people know what that's all about.
What is it?
The Pluto salute
describe it to me.
I have to start back. That's a little bit involved. So let me try your patience and start in 1930. After a 25-year search to find what was then called Planet X, this young, off-the-farm, Depression-era young man named Clyde Tombaugh accomplished what astronomers had tried to achieve since 1905. In 1930, he discovered that Planet X, which became Pluto by name later that year, the ninth planet. And what Tombaugh did was so monumental. Not only had he achieved what other people couldn't over 25 years, people in the research astronomical community looked and looked and looked and looked across six decades until the 1990s before more planets were found in the outer solar system. Tombaugh was two generations ahead of his time. Not just his ingenuity, because he reinvented the whole technique for how they made the discovery, but his concentration. He did mind-numbing things that we would never entertain today. We'd use a computer to analyze all that data. And so we have something in the Pluto project that's meant to celebrate Tombaugh's legacy. And it's a little salute that you take two hands, one hand with five fingers and one hand with four fingers, and you hold them up for Planet Nine and for Tombaugh's accomplishment. And there are pictures all over the web of people on the New Horizons project and the public, for that matter, in small and large groups holding up their two hands with nine fingers, meaning, attaboy, Tombaugh, you really did something amazing.
Didn't the craft carry some of the ashes, a portion of Clyde Tombaugh's ashes in a container?
It did. And we carried some other mementos as well, but that's probably the one that's most sentimental and maybe even most well known.
What does the inscription say on the container?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but it's just a couple of sentences that I wrote about who Tombaugh was as the discoverer of the third zone of our solar system and the son of his parents, Miron and Adele, and the husband of his wife, Patsy, and the father of his children, Annette and Alden. Again, what he accomplished, and then his name and his dates, 1906 to 1997.
I'm going to leave the discoveries of what you saw in the flyby to the people that buy the book, and I hope they will. But I do want to ask you about whether there was anything on anybody's drawing board when it comes to space exploration that you think matches the boldness and the excitement of the New Horizons project.
I think. For me, and others might say differently, but for me, I think what matches that boldness is sending humans to other worlds, and we haven't done that in a long time, almost half a century now since humans walked on the moon. But we're going to see humans now not just go back to the moon, but go to Mars and to other destinations. I often say that I think that this coming decade, the 2020s, is literally where Star Trek begins. And I think I'm quite optimistic that we are on the verge of a really historic evolution of our species off the home planet and onto other worlds that will be viewed as an epical change in the human condition to a multi-planet species that will echo across not just the centuries, but the millennia to come.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Stern is a planetary scientist. He's project manager of the New Horizons expedition and co-author, along with David Grinspoon, of Chasing New Horizons Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. If you missed it, and you only heard a part of that conversation with Alan, find it on my podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you download your podcasts.